This is R.N. Ross, Southwest Regional Director of American Atheists, author of Foundational Falsehoods of Creationism, and you're listening to The Canadian Atheist.
Once you assume a creator and a plan, it makes us objects in a cruel experiment whereby we are created sick and commanded to be well. I'll repeat that. Created sick and then ordered to be well. And over us to supervise this is installed a celestial dictatorship, a kind of divine North Korea. Greedy, exigent, I would say more than exigent, greedy for uncritical praise from dawn till dusk, and swift to punish the original sins with which it so tenderly gifted us in the very first place. However, let no one say there's no cure. Salvation is offered. Redemption, indeed, is promised at the low price of the surrender of your critical faculties.
Welcome to The Canadian Atheist, a podcast about news, current events, and commentary on all things atheism from a Canadian perspective. Now, if this podcast carries the explicit tag and wears it like a motherfucking badge of honor, so if you get offended, you might want to switch off. The CA records each week live from Apostasy Studios. Why not join in the discussion? Find us on Facebook, email us at theca@rogers.com, or follow us on the old Twitter machine at @the_CA_podcast. If we're amused or tweaked by your stuff, we just might even use it on the show. And now, here are Michael and Dean.
All right, here we go. Welcome to CA. Today is, what the hell's today's date? I had it written down here. Forgot it already. Oh, yeah. Thursday, January 23rd, 2020. I'm Michael, and the first thing I have to do is apologize. I promise you Dean isn't locked up in my basement somewhere. He hasn't died or left the country, but as I've joked about before, he has a regular job, and we're doing this in the middle of the day, so it's difficult for him to join all the time. But this is episode 99. He will be back come hell or high water for episode 100, which we're working on now, and hopefully we have some fun stuff laid out for that. But joining me today for a conversation is a gentleman that I got some first exposure to, and you've heard me rail on this guy a little bit, but Cameron Bertuzzi, Capturing Christianity, on YouTube. But he had a great conversation, I guess it's going back about, I don't know, a few weeks ago now, with a gentleman named Chris Gadsden, who's out of Missouri. And so he's joined me today. We're going to have a little bit of a conversation talking about atheism and skepticism as well. And we'll see what else pops up and what other things we can get into trouble with. So, Chris, welcome to The Canadian Atheist.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's, seems like it's going to be fun.
Yeah. So you are out of Missouri.
That's right.
So it's only 2:30 your time right now.
That's correct.
Okay, so what do you do down there in Missouri?
Well, I do a couple different things. I teach as an adjunct instructor in the philosophy department here at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. But I also have worked with a campus ministry called CRU for the last 25 years. And that's, I'm kind of bivocational, I guess you'd say.
Is CRU, is that an acronym?
No, it's actually just sort of a made-up word, but CRU was formerly known as Campus Crusade for Christ,
okay,
which they abbreviated the name just to CRU. I think it has a different name up in Canada. I think the same organization has a different name, something like, I think it was Power to Change or something like that.
Not familiar with that. Okay. So philosophy, not my strong suit, but I think we can have some fun with it. So as we were talking about before I hit the record button, my first exposure to you was on Capturing Christianity's YouTube channel. And it was interesting because Cameron comes on and he says, you know, hey, I've got this other Christian with me and we're going to talk about what atheism means. And, you know, the collective atheist community rolled its eyes. I think it was interesting. And I think that there was a good start of a conversation with that. So I do want to talk about that. But I want to talk a little bit more about you because you said a few interesting things in that during that conversation. And so I want our listeners to get to know you a little bit more. So you identified as a Christian, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and I guess what the first question is, you know, well, kind of put like this, saying you're a Christian is like saying I drive a car, right? Mm. So can you tell me what kind of Christian you are?
Oh yeah, sure. That's a really good question. Yeah, there are so many flavors. You've probably heard the joke. It doesn't just apply to Christianity, but you know, you get five Christians in a room and seven opinions.
Oh, for sure. Yep.
On any topic, you know, I kind of like the term that C.S. Lewis coined or made famous of mere Christianity, sort of like simple Christianity. And so I don't necessarily identify with a particular denomination, but I like the idea of mere Christianity. It's sort of whatever unites all Christians, whether it's something like the Apostles' Creed or, you know, some sort of just core doctrinal statement that, you know, a Catholic and an Orthodox or a Protestant could affirm. You know, I suppose I like to think of myself as moderate as far as if there's a left and a right in Christianity, not just politically, but in terms of conservatism or liberalism.
Sure.
I tend to like middle areas, so I'm sort of a moderate, I guess you could say.
Okay. So you wouldn't consider yourself evangelical?
You know, I think that term, I used to like that term a lot, what it represented, but it's changed in terms of what it represents. And that's one of the funny things about culture is words actually, their definitions can change and their connotations can change. And so that, you know, I think if I'm sitting with some other evangelical Christians, I might identify as an evangelical, but if I'm out in the public, that word carries a lot of negative connotations now. So I don't use it often. But
yeah, it does have a, you know, you're right. It's got a ton of baggage attached to it now, for sure. Yeah. So not charismatic. You don't dance around with snakes and speak in tongues and stuff like that.
No, I've never done that. I'll try anything once, I suppose.
Oh, okay. Well, dancing with the snakes, that can be dangerous. Sometimes the one chance is the only one you get.
I hear you've got some snakes, so maybe I could.
I'm sure you could dance with Buttercup. She'd love it. But there's also no, virtually zero chance she'd bite you. And even if she did, couldn't possibly hurt you. Okay. So, and then something else that you, said that was interesting when you were talking to Cameron was you said that you were once an atheist.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's interesting. So the first thing I'm not going to do is I'm not going to say, well, you were never really an atheist. Like, like we've heard so many Christians say, well, if you were once a Christian, now you were never really a Christian. Right. I'll certainly never tar you with that brush, but I am curious of a couple of things. So one, if you could tell us a little bit about, whether you were raised as a believer, or whether you were raised, you know, kind of in a more skeptical household, what kind of made you change your mind? Mm-hmm. And then what changed your mind back?
Oh, I see.
So what led you away from a belief in a God?
Okay.
And then what led you back to a belief in a God?
Well, so I would say, my parents, I like to say my parents were hippies, you know, I mean, that's probably the best way to describe the culture I grew up in. We had the VW van with the curtains in it and, you know, the whole nine yards. And, so my parents were not religious at all. We never went to church. It wasn't something we talked about much. I had some, you know, interesting conversations with my dad over the years, just about life, the universe and everything. I read all the Douglas Adams books, of course. So my parents, if anything, they might've been a little in the new age side of things. They read a lot of Carlos Castaneda, if you've ever heard of him. My dad was a big fan of Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay.
So those are some old names, you know, but, so I grew up in a fairly non-religious, not hostile to religion. It just was not something that was really on the radar.
Okay.
So I think by the time I was a senior in high school, junior or senior, when I really started thinking more deeply about it, that's when I really would, I would tell people I was an atheist. And, you know, I started trying to look for literature to read and reading Carl Sagan. And I remember picking up some Frank Zappa and just reading other stuff, trying to make sense of life in whatever way I could. I was reading Freud and, you know, of course, I loved Douglas Adams and Monty Python and a lot of other
right, yep.
sources of wisdom. Yeah, and then I headed off to college and I was a music major, music education. I played the saxophone. And, you know, I that kind of kept me going down the same path. I remember having conversations with professors who were atheists and just finding that really fascinating. Like, wow, how do you raise your kids? What do? You know, and I remember having a girlfriend and telling her, you know, if we ever got married, we can't get married in a church. And I don't, you know, we're not going to celebrate Christmas. We're not going to celebrate Easter. You know, I mean, I was like, if I'm going to be an atheist, I'm going to be consistent all the way and not just do it for, you know, do all the Christian things for show.
Okay.
But then, some interesting things started to happen about my junior year of college. I developed a friendship with this guy who was probably the first Christian who was brave enough to have a conversation with me. Most people were probably, I was kind of a hostile, prickly atheist, so I like to argue a lot. And so this guy wasn't intimidated at all. So we got to be friends. We'd debate often and, you know, always taking complete opposite sides on things. And then there were a couple different circumstances that were sort of brewing. And then I went to an event. I went to go see this concert at the invitation of this Christian friend. And he said, oh, you have to come. They have this amazing saxophone player who studied at Eastman, amazing jazz player. And I was like, okay. So I went to this concert and the saxophone player was quite good, actually. But it was, a Christian band, and they were talking a lot about their faith in between songs. And honestly, it was something I had never really heard in my life. I'd never heard people talk about God the way they were talking about it. It was very new to me. And it was at the end of that event, when they invited people to come forward kind of in an old fashioned altar call, and just invited people to come forward who wanted to be prayed for or who had questions. And something happened to me at that point in the evening that I've talked about many times with people. And the best explanation still to me is that God just sort of, just hit me over the head. There was really no other way I can explain it. It wasn't something I was expecting. It wasn't something I had any category for. I'd been in a church, like that kind of church, an evangelical church, probably once in my life, as far as I know. So I had no categories. I wasn't expecting it. It wasn't something that I was sort of primed for. It was just a very radical experience suddenly of the reality of God. And that night, you know, I sat down and talked with somebody, and one of the musicians, and they encouraged me to, you know, place my faith in Christ. And I did it right there on the spot. And I kind of just did a 180, and it's just been kind of an adventure ever since then. Hmm. All my friends and my family are pretty freaked out though.
And are they still?
No, I think after time, I, you know, my parents, they saw that I hadn't gone crazy and, you know, that I was approaching it in a fairly reasonable way. They didn't agree with my stance. You know, my father considered himself to be an atheist, even though we didn't talk a ton about it. And my mom just kind of, she's kind of neutral on the subject. But most people eventually, if they didn't agree with me, at least they respected the decision or respected the change.
Okay. So that's interesting. So you went from, you know, essentially a non-theist or de facto atheist kind of background, doesn't really get talked about, stuff like that, to going to this concert and then kind of boom. So did you ever, after that day, okay, so now I'm going to do this, but is there something that convinced you that, or how have you remained convinced that it's Yahweh and Jesus and not Vishnu or Allah?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, when I look back on that event, it was sort of a generic, I'd say maybe a generic experience of God. The experience itself, I don't take to have had any Christian features or anything that's, you know, that would isolate it down to just Christianity. But the context that I was in is what brought that interpretation of it, which I think is fine. It doesn't mean, I can't infer from that was the correct interpretation. But to me, it's clear evidence of God's existence. And then I think once you have that sort of under your belt and you're trying to decide, well, which religion or which expression is the correct one or is the appropriate one, at that point, that's when I would engage reason and just evaluating different religious beliefs as well as you can with the information you have, and just saying, well, which seems to be the most reasonable, the most coherent, the most consistent with my experience. And that's for me, that's Christianity.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting, and I appreciate the honesty. So then a few questions just about kind of from your Christian perspective.
Yeah.
And feel free to, you know, kind of take as much time or anything to talk about any of these that you want to. So you're a Christian. Are you I don't want to put labels on you. That's okay. Not what I'm trying to do, but I'm just trying to get an idea again from like the flavor of Christianity, right?
Yeah.
Because, for example, Young Earth?
No.
Okay. So if I was to ring up Kent Hovind right now and Kent Hovind was to talk to you, be like, what are you talking about? The Bible says 6 days, 6,000 years. What's wrong with you? Okay. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the flavor. So do you accept evolution?
I'll say this, that I think it's consistent with the Christian worldview, and that I don't think you have to choose between evolution or Christianity. I think that they actually are, they're not at odds with one another.
Okay. So then you're not a biblical literalist.
Well, I'm literal about the literal parts.
Okay.
Right. So I think there's some nuance here that is important, and that is the Bible is this incredible collection of many different genres of literature. You have everything from law, poetry, prophecy, historical narrative, and then a lot of other sort of uncommon genres. And so some of those are meant to be taken literally and some of them are not, right? So poetry, typically, most people understand is not intended to be taken strictly literal, right? So there are, you know, passages in the Psalms, you know, the great poetic, one of the great poetic sections of the Bible, that describe God as, you know, hiding you under the shadow of his wings and expressions like that. And I don't think
that's just before, just after he says, you know, we'll keep you from all harm or something, isn't it? Is that 121 or something? 121 or 126?
Yeah, I couldn't name it. Yeah. Maybe you're better on that than I am. But, you know, nobody thinks that God literally has wings like a bird or a bat or something. At least no one that I know thinks that. So, I mean, those things are meant to be metaphors. And if it does say, and I'll protect you from all harm, that may very well not be meant to be taken literal either.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's clearly, like, if somebody was to say to me and I've had conversations with Bible literalists, and I'll throw that, say, well, the Bible clearly says God will keep you from all harm. And then they'll say something like you just said, only frankly, they'll be more dishonest about it and say, well, you know, you're taking it out of context, which is something I hear from Christians all the time. What I typically do in that case, I say, well, okay, well, let's talk about something like, I love talking about slavery. You know, you read the entirety of Exodus 21. It's really clearly laid out. I don't want to jump down that rabbit hole, but I understand where you're coming from. And again, I'm not trying to pigeonhole you into anything in particular. Okay. So then how do you, first tough question. How did you determine what was to be taken literally versus what's metaphorical and what's allegorical?
Well, most of the Bible sort of sorts itself out just by reading it. I mean, there are a lot of cues that are sort of embedded in literature that tell you what sort of genre you're reading, right? So if I were to start a story, if I said here, or if I just started talking to you and I said, you know, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there lived, you know.
Oh, now you're talking my language, Star Wars.
Right,
baby.
Right. So you would know, well, of course, you know, I'm copying Star Wars, but of course, I mean, if I said once upon a time in a land far away, you'd go, oh, that's a cue that tells me I'm going to be hearing a fairy tale or some fictional story.
Sure.
And that tells you how to understand what I'm saying from that point forward. You wouldn't start thinking, oh my gosh, you've met an alien, you know. You'd know that that's, you know, this isn't some kind of fairy story. And similarly, if there are other cues, you know, if somebody says, hey, yesterday on the corner of Main Street and 4th, there was a person in a red jacket leaning on a lamppost. You'd probably think I'm just doing reporting. I'm just giving you sort of a historical report of some actual event, because it doesn't have the cues or the ornamentation of like a fairy tale or a poem or something like that. So a lot of the Bible is like that. It's just fairly obvious to a person who is sensitive to genre distinctions. It's fairly obvious what you're dealing with. Now, there are some passages that are difficult that I'll admit, like, you know, when I read, I'm like, okay, I'm not quite sure what to do with this.
Can you give us an example of one that you've struggled with?
Well, you know, Genesis 1 and 2 are notorious.
Yeah, they're bad.
They're notorious, and I just sort of meant as, you know, known for being difficult because they don't really fit into almost any genre that we know of. The best I've heard someone describe it is epic, what was it? A cosmic epic, you know, as sort of the genre and the way to understand that, and which would allow for some non-literal interpretations, but not completely fabricated. So that's a difficult one. And I struggle to really have a really firm ground on how I interpret Genesis 1 and 2. It's hard. You know, other passages, you know, there are some narratives. I had a friend one time, we were talking about the story where one of the sons of David, the great king of Israel, David, one of his sons, Absalom, had rebelled against him. And at one point in the narrative, Absalom is trying to escape. I think he's trying to escape, and he rides his horse through this thick area of lots of trees and bushes, and he gets caught and he gets pulled right off his horse because he has this long hair, and his hair gets caught in the bushes or the tree, and it yanks him right off his horse, and he's stuck there with his hair caught in the tree. And people have said, now this is supposed to represent something else. It's like a metaphor for something. And I thought, well, I don't know. Couldn't it have just been that's what happened? Or was it added later as sort of to make a special point about Absalom? I don't know. I mean, those are some passages that there are lots of places like that where you go, now, wait a minute, did that actually happen? Or is that something added to make a point, you know?
I mean, you make an interesting point. I mean, you could see that happening, right? I mean, my dog goes outside and goes through the bushes and comes inside with burrs on him. Right. So you can see that happening, and that's more plausible than like a donkey talking. Right.
Yeah, some of them are difficult to know exactly what's. I mean, what I try to do is I try to say, okay, if I could put myself in the shoes of an audience in that culture in that time, how would I understand that at that point? Hmm. Would I? And that's difficult to do. I mean, we are so far removed from the original audience that it's very difficult to put yourself in their shoes. But, you know, put myself in the shoes of the teller in that culture. What were the standard ways of telling stories in that culture? And were they doing it like a reporter in the 21st century would do? Or are they doing it as a bard in the, you know, medieval bard who travels from town to town telling stories with song would do, you know? So mm-hmm. It's difficult to... There are some real difficult passages like that.
Yeah, and it is interesting because, you know, it's like, again, you know, when I want to jump into skepticism in a minute, because, you know, I look at that and, you know, having read the Bible a lot, I think to myself, well, what about, you know, the Bible says God is not the author of confusion. And when you read this stuff, it's like, this is confusing. And so like, these are some of the things that, you know, that I've, you know, struggled with. You read it, it's like, okay, well, you talked about Genesis 1 and 2, right? And, you know, you look at Genesis 1 and 2 and you talk to a Bible literalist, you know, 6 days, 6,000 years. I'm like, yeah, but I don't care what your book says. We know that didn't happen that way. Like we know the science and that that's not what happened. Right. And so, but I think you put an interesting spin. I don't want to call it an apologetic spin, but I think you put an interesting spin on it in that, you know, it's like maybe the time, maybe the place, maybe how this was written and who was written by. You know, this is the best explanation they had at the time. That's fairly unsatisfying to someone on my side of the fence when we can look at the science and say, yeah, but we know better than this. It can be hard to reconcile.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's reasonable. I mean, I think it's okay to bring science to bear on these issues as well, to say, for trying to determine the right interpretation of a passage, well, does it conflict with, you know, known things that are a consensus scientifically? Then I think that's a point against that interpretation.
Mm, interesting. Thank you for that. That's more honest than I've heard a lot of, that's more honesty than I've heard from a lot of Christians to be perfect, to be really, really blunt about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to the whole atheism thing.
Sure.
My father-in-law, who's a staunch Catholic, as much as I'm trying to reform him from his evil ways, he taught philosophy. Is very philosophically mm-hmm. minded, and we joust back and forth a lot. Yeah. And I don't know a lot about philosophy, which will be interesting when we get into the skeptical side of things. When you talked about kind of your categories of skepticism, but I accept the utility of philosophy. I really do. Sometimes it pisses me off. Because you can put together a syllogism that is logically sound and completely false, and yet it's interesting. And one of the things that I like that I've had interesting discussions talking about are the definitions of atheism. Right, that conversation you had with Cameron. How do you define atheism?
Yeah, well, I mean, put simply, I would just say it's denial of a proposition, the proposition being God exists. If you deny or disbelieve that proposition, then you're an atheist.
See, I find that fascinating for someone who teaches philosophy, because if you look at like I don't know how much you like the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, whether or not you think it's a piece of trash or not, but it's it's the only book that I have easy access to when it comes to philosophy.
Right. Yeah.
Because what essentially you just did was kind of quote the dictionary definition, which is something that I've heard a lot of people involved in philosophy don't like. Because if you look at the philosophical definition of atheism, it's the statement that God or gods do not exist. Versus the dictionary definition of, you know, the lack of a belief in a god or gods.
Okay. Well, yeah, there are nuances there. I mean,
yeah. Explain that. I'm dying to hear your take on that.
Well, one of the reasons I think that talking about what atheism is something that anybody, regardless of their worldview, can talk about is because we're just, I would never try to say, oh, here's what all atheists think, or here's how atheists, this is their experience, or this is, you know, what they believe. I'm just talking about a concept, and concepts are just, you know, they just kind of are free floating things like justice. What is justice? You don't have to have any sort of pedigree to interact over that concept and say, well, what's the most coherent definition of this term? And so defining justice and defining atheism are the same kind of task.
Okay.
I could be a really unjust person and have a perfectly coherent definition of justice, that I just don't live by.
Right.
Right. So, you know, atheism is a concept. And I find sometimes it's more helpful to just take a step back and just talk about epistemology for a second and just say, you know, well, we only have a few possible ways you can look at any proposition. And sometimes we call it a dogmatic attitude or a stance you might take toward it. So if, mm-hmm. you know, if there's a proposition like, you know, the number of stars in the universe is even, just something random and weird like that, you know,
sure.
the number of stars in the universe is even. And you said, well, what is your dogmatic attitude or your sort of your belief state regarding that proposition? Now, for this case, I'd say I am undecided.
Sure. I would say I'm agnostic on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a fair way to say undecided. I mean, that's been a culturally sort of typical way people talk about being undecided on something.
Mm-hmm.
They use the word agnostic. But just to avoid the labels for a second, let's just say undecided because that sure. doesn't carry any connotations with it. You know, absolutely. I neither believe it nor do I disbelieve it. I don't affirm it. I don't deny it. I'm just neutral, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's really only those three possible positions you can take on any particular proposition that you're considering. There just isn't anything else, you know, conceptually.
Right.
Now, you can have a belief. There might be, you know, something like degrees of belief, or you might have a very strong or very, you might have a lot of confidence in your belief, but it's a belief nonetheless. So I just say, you know, if you believe the proposition God exists, then you're a theist. If you deny it or disbelieve it, then you're an atheist. And if you are undecided, you're an agnostic. And that's kind of a traditional way. And but I totally understand why atheists are trying to reform that language.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've had a lot of discussions with people about this. And you're right in that it is contested within the quote unquote community. And I haven't spoken to people like Aaron Raw, who's a Southwest Regional Director for American Atheists, wrote a book, Foundational Falsehoods of Creationism. He's been on the podcast. I've met him, super nice guy. A former president of American Atheists, David Silverman, wrote a book called Fighting God, you know, where he said, you know, if your worldview does not include a God, you are an atheist, you know, kind of hard stamp, right? Like, you know, firebrand, that kind of thing. And I have taken the stance that that is not a hill or a sword I'm willing to throw myself on. I will use the label you want. If you want to call yourself, you know, like for you, like if you want to call yourself a, you know, middle of the road, you know, kind of, you know, nominal moderate Christian, cool. I'm not going to toss a label on you and say, oh, you're X, Y, or Z. If people say they're an atheist, fine. If people say they're an anti-theist, cool. I don't see the necessity to say, oh, you don't believe in a God, you're an atheist. Oh no, I'm agnostic. No, you're not, you're an atheist. You want to call yourself an agnostic, fill your boots. I don't care. It's not worth it to me. And from the atheist perspective, like we've got, and again, speaking just from kind of quote unquote our side, we've got bigger fish to fry than arguing over the term you want to use to identify yourself with. There are groups out there that are trying to take away a woman's right to bodily autonomy. Who cares whether or not you want to call yourself an atheist or an agnostic.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I resonate with that. I mean, for sure, it's easy to get caught up in maybe the things that are less life-altering, less pressing. And it is a sort of an academic debate or an intellectual debate that, you know, may or may not have any real significant repercussions in the actual world of our day-to-day lives. But, you know, philosophers, I mean, that's kind of our thing. We really like defining things and talking about concepts and refining our concepts. I mean, if you read Socrates, this is, you know, the aim of many of his dialogues, you know. So and it can have important implications. I mean, when people are debating these things, and I think it is whether God exists or not is an important subject.
Sure.
And when we debate it, what happens is if we don't have the same, if we can't agree on some definitions, then we really can't even have a debate, a productive debate. So at least for that sake, like to actually be able to say, let's talk about why someone should or shouldn't believe in God. That's when we have to really get our definitions at least consistent. We have to agree. Whatever the definitions are, we have to agree on them. Hmm. But I understand why. It's not a hill I would die on either, you know. And I'm willing to, you know, flex quite a bit on this just for the sake of, you know, agreement.
Okay, cool. I want to talk about your YouTube series now. So for everybody out there listening, I'll make sure I put a link in the podcast description so you can find Chris's podcast. It's really clever, and I don't mean that in any way other than I think it's clever. The YouTube series is called Thinking Outside, and it's you talking about stuff outside. I think it's brilliant. Yeah. I think it's really, really, it's clever. It's just really kind of clever. So I think you're up to episode 5 now. I've not watched the latest one on Slippery Slope. I haven't had a chance to watch yet. I've been recovering from a cold. Maybe people can hear that too. So what was the idea behind the YouTube series? How'd that get started?
Well, you know, I've dabbled with YouTube on and off and, have tried to find something that kind of worked for me and would kind of be fun to do. And there are just a million and one talking heads out there on the internet, and everybody wants to be on YouTube. My kids are really into YouTube. They have YouTube channels, you know, and, so I thought, well, I don't want to do just the same old thing everybody else is doing. And I have a few YouTubers that I watch, a few channels that I like. And one of them, it's a guy who does yoga. He's a yoga instructor. Okay. And he does all his videos outside. And I really like that. And so that was something that was kind of floating in the back of my mind. And I love being outside. I love being on trails and walking around outside. And so my daughter took a trip to New York, and then she came back and she had a photo that she was trying to take of a sign that said "Think outside the box."
Okay.
But the photo got cut off, and so it just said "Think outside." And I thought, "Think outside. That's it."
That's
so
very cool.
I just thought, well, maybe I'll just try this. I'll go talk about these ideas, philosophy and, you know, apologetic kind of issues maybe and critical thinking, but I'll just do it while I'm walking around outside. And I don't know. It's been fun. I really enjoy doing it.
And your daughter has starred in at least one of them with you.
That's right. Well, that's my younger daughter. I have an older daughter who's actually my editor. She's doing all the editing. I was advised by some other friends who are good with these sort of things. They're like, yeah, you know, if you want to have an appeal to younger people too, you ought to just let your daughter edit everything because she knows how to do it. It's like, okay. And so it's been a nice partnership. So
that's cool. So the one, I guess the first video of yours that I watched, after you were on Capturing Christianity was the one on skepticism. I want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Cause you kind of broke it into four areas. And so just for everybody, but I encourage everyone after you're done listening to this, go into YouTube, look up Chris Gadsden. It's just a picture of you, right? It's just you on the YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And click on that. And there's a few videos, there's a pilot and then, a few other ones, but The one on skepticism was interesting because it was when you were walking through your campus, I guess. And the first one's a trigger because it says childish. And it was interesting because when I first watched the video, I got, you know, insert expletive deleted here. Oh, I guess I should have said that for this episode, because Chris is a Christian and wants the capacity to share the podcast, that's why I haven't sworn yet, guys. You know me better than this. So this episode is clean.
Which is very considerate of you, because he's thinking about my listeners as well and what I can share with my audience. So I really appreciate that consideration.
No problem at all. So the first one's a huge trigger. You call it childish. But I'll just list the four, and then I'd like you to go through each of them and talk about them a little bit.
Sure.
So that there's childish, cynical, philosophical, and then you the first one you said childish, cynical, and then you put healthy, and then you during the video you talk, it's almost like you did the whole quote unquote thinking outside, and then added the philosophical in there. Talk about each one of those for a second. Actually,
sure. These different kinds of skepticism.
Yeah.
And this is not a something that I'm writing a detailed publishable paper about, but more just musings. But when I think of the first kind of skepticism, I'll mention is philosophical, and I think of Descartes, right? So Descartes, who just set about to doubt everything because he wanted to try to find if there was anything in his belief network that he could actually rely on and say, now this is the one thing that I can't doubt. And he did. He found basically his own existence as the one thing he couldn't doubt. And then he kind of built up from there. And that's just sort of a philosophical exercise. I'm not sure how much Descartes actually experienced psychological doubt. Like, was he really worried about all these things being false and, you know, that he was actually in the Matrix or something? And of course, he didn't think of the Matrix. He just thought of, you know, I'm being deceived by an evil demon or something, or I'm sleeping. You know, it's like Inception.
Sure.
So that's just more of a philosophical exercise meant to sort of improve our stock of beliefs. You know, to examine our beliefs and find out which ones are, which ones we know and which ones we're just guessing at or are less reliable. So, and I think that's a fine project to have. I admire Descartes for doing that, and he's given us lots to talk about for a couple hundred years. But then there are some other ways that people are skeptics, I think. And I use the term childish just for lack of a better term. I think in the blog post, I tried to use a different kind of term, but it's people that maybe have learned a little bit about skepticism and then just sort of throw it around haphazardly at anything they don't like. And this goes not just for, you know, non-theists, but it, you know, lots of Christians do it too. And we could just go into all kinds of conversations about vaccines and homeopathic medicine.
Please don't.
Okay, I won't. But there are things that, you know, this is not something that only an atheist or a non-theist would do. But anyone who just starts to doubt things mainly because they don't like it, so they just kind of use the doubt wand on whatever they want, or as a defense, you know, like, well, we don't really know anything about that, so we can't talk about it. And I think that's kind of a irresponsible way to use the idea of skepticism. But then there's also people who I think what I call the cynical skeptic is someone who is just kind of worn out maybe in the whole conversation and of trying to figure things out. And then they just kind of come to the end of their rope, so to speak. And they're just like, okay, there's no way to know this. I give up. We just can't know it. It's unknowable. Therefore there's no truth. There are no facts of the matter. And so we're just going to talk about our feelings instead, you know? And I think that's kind of cynical because it's sort of a throwing in the towel. And again, I don't think that's the best way to use skepticism or to just resort to that cynical point of view. But a healthy skepticism, I think, is a person that takes a skeptical stance in the appropriate times, in the appropriate way, when, you know, they're being given some information and and there's no support or reasons or evidence being given for the information, they can stop and go, now hold on a second. I'm not just going to believe this. I'm not just going to buy what you're saying because, you know, you have a nice suit on or something. And that's a healthy skepticism. And even just reflecting on your own beliefs sometimes and just turning that skeptical lens toward yourself and saying, now, you know, why do I believe this? And is this really a good reason? And that's sort of a self-reflective use of skepticism that I think is good to do some house cleaning now and then. And it doesn't mean you always come up with the answers or that it always leads you to truth, but it's a good exercise to just look at your beliefs now and then and in light of maybe new evidence that you've gained or new experiences and that might actually change your mind. So that's a little bit of a rundown.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it was Bertrand Russell who said every once in a while we should hang a question mark on our most closely held beliefs.
Oh, I like that.
And here's a question for you. And again, not to put you over the barrel or anything.
Okay.
From your perception or your opinion, how do you think most atheists, or which one of your four do you think most atheists employ?
Oh, you're totally holding me over the barrel. No. What do most atheists...
Go with healthy.
Yeah, I'd say atheists are all over the board, just like theists are all over the board.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, what do you think most theists do?
I think most theists aren't skeptical enough.
Wow, you heard it here first, people.
What's that?
I said you heard it here first, people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now I don't think this is something, you know, like my 12-year-old daughter needs to go through an exercise or something like this. But adults, for sure, you know. Okay. I think adults need to take responsibility for their beliefs and not just ride on their, you know, whatever they heard in Sunday school forever. That's not going to cut it, you know. So I think it's good for everybody to exercise a little bit of healthy skepticism, especially, I mean, think about relationships, not just belief in God. I mean, that's just one of millions of things you ought to think about more seriously. I mean, but just when people tell you things in the context of a relationship, sometimes you have to have a little healthy skepticism. You know, you want to believe the best about people, that they're being honest and so forth. But sometimes you have to go, you know, I'm not sure I can really trust what this person's saying right now. But I don't know when, if somehow I could just take a poll or take the pulse of the internet community, like the internet atheist community.
Or maybe it was unfair. How about in your experience?
My experience. Well, I'll tell you, my experience in the last 10 years has been much more positive than maybe the first 10 years that I started thinking about these things.
Okay.
But I have a lot of atheist friends now, and a lot of them are very, very serious thinkers, and I think have a very healthy skepticism. Now, I think we all occasionally, you know, it's difficult to peg any one person in any one category, because I think we can be healthy in some areas and some questions and maybe more childish in other questions.
Diplomatic.
Yeah, you know, that's I hate to just give the diplomatic kind of answer, but I mean, I have a friend who I won't mention names, but, you know, who I have a great deal of respect for, and we talk frequently, and I just respect the heck out of him and the way he approaches the questions, especially about God. You know, we get together, you know, a couple times a month and just have these, you know, 3 or 4 hour conversations. So I think he's just a great model for how to think about things. But I do come across, I mean, the comment section and some of these videos that I've done, a few live interviews and things. I mean, the comment sections are just riddled with childish skepticism. But the Christians aren't doing a much better job. You know, they're sort of a little too credulous in a sense. And
interesting.
You know, and so I think we all, I mean, there's room to grow for everyone. And so we all have a little bit of that childish skepticism in some areas and maybe healthy in other areas. So Yeah, that is kind of a diplomatic answer, I guess.
No, it's interesting, though, because you think of, I think about people, and one of my favorite examples is Francis Collins. Are you familiar with who Francis Collins is?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, here's a guy, the Human Genome Project, right? Mapping out, right. The human genome. Bible-believing Christian.
Yeah.
Right? So here's a person who, who accepts the science in all of these areas, but he still has, and I don't mean it disrespectfully, but he still has this God box, where he says, I'm going to do all of these things in all of these areas. I'm going to accept the fact that, we are apes, and I'm going to accept the fact that we're animals and all these things, because the science clearly shows that. But I'm also going to, hold aside this little box here where, I believe in the Trinity and all these other things because of, because of a water formation I saw when I went out for a walk one day. So, I think that I think what you said is fair in a lot of ways because, there's these people who maybe don't exercise, or it might even be fair to say that a person has all four of these areas operating in their mind at different times and on different days about different subjects.
Mm, yeah.
That might be fair to say.
Yeah. I think, like you brought up Francis Collins, and I have a lot of respect for him. I read his book, The Language of God, I think is the title of it. I think one thing that we have to be careful not to assume, and I think people do this, is they assume, well, he's using good methodology in his thinking about science, but then when it comes to religion, he's using a different methodology, and it's leading him to the wrong decisions or the wrong conclusions. But in defense of Francis Collins and other people like him, I'd say, I think they're using the same methodology, the same very rigorous scientific, step-by-step process. And I do think epistemology is very scientific. The way we think about our beliefs, it has all the marks of scientific method. He's using the same approach to draw conclusions about God as well. And I think sometimes people just think that can't be the case because, well, if they were using the right, a good scientific method, they would come to the conclusion that there's no God because, of course, that's the truth.
I don't know if I want to say right. Sorry, I mean to cut you off there. I don't know if I want to say right, but it is, that one's a hard, that's a hard one for someone who tries to be the healthy skeptic. And I love the wording you used in the video where you talk about using your skeptical muscles, right?
Yeah.
I like that analogy. In that's hard for the skeptic or the atheist to reconcile because, then it goes into this whole other can of worms because if you say, okay, well, if he's using the same epistemological framework to come to his belief in a God as he does to all these other things, well, these other things that we can show, test, and demonstrate that we have literally mountains of evidence for, all these separate independent lines of evidence all converging on the same facts. And then we flip the page to, this is what a book says. That's harder for someone like me. And I shouldn't say atheist community. I should just speak for myself. That's hard for me to reconcile.
Yeah, no. And that's well put. And the reason why I would disagree is because most of us, when we think about what counts as evidence, and what can count as support for a conclusion, we're thinking very narrowly of empirical evidence, like things that the hard sciences deal with, things that I can touch, taste, smell, see, feel, whatever, and I hear. Mm-hmm. But evidence encompasses many more things than just empirical evidence. I would count logic and argument, like, the ability to think philosophically and reason from premises to a conclusion using logic, that's a kind of evidence for a conclusion. It's the evidence of reason or inference. Experiences count as part of our evidence. That doesn't automatically just magically make all our experiences valid or veridical, you know, true, there can be false or misleading evidence, right? But experiences do count as part of our evidence. There's introspection, you know, of course, that only gives us evidence about our internal bodily and mental states. But reason and experience, these things are part of our evidential base. And I think it's not that Francis Collins changes up his methodology in thinking about this, thinking about God, as opposed to thinking about science. It's that he's dealing with a different evidential base than, say, someone like you or me, or, I mean, no two people have exactly the same evidential base, which is one of the reasons we come to different conclusions.
That's probably fair. It's interesting. So here's something that my father-in-law and I argue about constantly. He accuses me, and I think he's mostly being fair. He says, you don't allow philosophy as a way to come to knowledge.
Mm.
And I think for the most part, he's right. Because like I said before, you can come up with a syllogism that is logically sound and still inaccurate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it seems to me, and so that was a statement, but then a question that I have as well, what would be the best book that someone like me could read to break past that barrier and to see why I should accept the philosophical at or close to the same level as the empirical?
Wow, what a great question. No one's ever asked me that before, and I am absolutely stumped right at the moment.
Send me an email or a Twitter thing later.
Yeah, because that is a great question. I'm going to have to think about that and see if I can come up with something, because, man, that would be great if there was just one nice thing to read. I mean, some of it is, it's understanding what philosophy is kind of a step in that direction, because, I mean, there's a reason why, I mean, the pursuit of knowledge in the Western world was always just philosophy. And then eventually it started branching off as we gained more and more different categories, where natural philosophy. So the sciences are just natural philosophy. Hmm. And I mean, inferring from evidence to conclusions is nothing more than, it's a syllogism. I mean, it's just a logical argument that you're using premises and conclusions. So it's impossible to walk away from philosophy in any possible discipline. Every discipline uses the same logical principles and assumptions of philosophy, going all the way back to Socrates. So, but yeah, I'm going to think about that. If there's a good book that would really do a good job presenting that. Because I do see, this is one thing that happens a lot. There are a lot of scientists out there who are very public and very, you know, very, very vocal about their beliefs in terms of God and religion, who are wonderful scientists. They're absolutely brilliant at what they do, but they are awful philosophers. And they talk about philosophy as if, you know, the funny thing is they have to use philosophy to critique philosophy, and they don't even realize that's what they're doing, because it's impossible to even argue against philosophy without using it, or to say science is really the only kind of knowledge there is. And that itself is a philosophical statement. There's no scientific test for that, you know? So, but yeah, I, as I've studied philosophy, I've just grown more and more to respect it as a foundational, it's just the foundation of all knowledge, to be honest. So
is it fair to say that you view philosophy and the scientific method as co-equal ways of coming to knowledge?
The scientific method just is philosophy.
Okay.
It's all of a piece, or how, I'm not sure how to say that, but they're all one family. There's no separation. The scientific method is a child of philosophy, if it's even to be considered a separate entity. It's the offspring. It's part of the family. You know, I mean, the idea of being reasonable and logical and believing according to the evidence is science. It's good science and it's good philosophy. And that's just no way around that from my point of view.
Okay. So then where do you, okay. So then as a Christian, at what point, do you, I don't want this to sound like a poke, but at what point do you invoke faith?
Hmm. Yeah. So, you know, this is another term that is really hard to define, and everybody has their own kind of definition of what faith is. For me, faith is not this really unusual, magical thing. It's a pretty mundane experience. It's a kind of trust, or it's an active trust in something you have good reason to believe is true. So many people think of faith as something, it's like believing without evidence or against the evidence. But
well, that is what I find that is what the Bible says, though.
It really doesn't.
Well, that's the faith is a hope for things unseen.
Well, that doesn't say anything about evidence, right? There are things unseen that we have evidence for, things that are too small for us to detect, or things that are, the only way we can detect them is indirectly by their effects in the world.
Yeah, but we still have the capacity to measure those things. Doesn't
mean there's no evidence for it. What's that?
We still have the capacity to measure those things, though. Like, I remember here once, I remember when I was still learning all this stuff, I got stumped by someone who said, you know, can you see the wind? And it pushed me back for a second. Then after about 5 seconds, right. I was like, that's silly. I can measure the wind. Like, we have tests for that.
Wind is not a great example, but justice is.
Yeah. Right? And it is interesting because we talked before, like you mentioned justice before, and how, you know, you can be able to define it really well, but doesn't mean you exercise it at all. That is interesting. Which forces the next question. Sorry, yeah. finish your statement first.
I was just going to say, you know, personhood is another concept that is impossible to decide on based strictly on scientific empirical evidence. Like, what counts as a person? That's a philosophical question at its very core, you know. But it's crucial because, you know, who counts as a person, what counts as a person depends on how we treat things. So if a dog counts as a person, then it's going to be really you're not going to be allowed to treat it certain ways. And sure. You're going to have to, you know, but people say, no, it doesn't count as a person. And well, why not? Well, that's not a scientific question, you know, because any distinction that we draw scientifically, we say, well, it doesn't have the ability to do X, Y, and Z. Well, why should that count as the criteria for personhood? That's a philosophical question and you cannot escape it. It's impossible.
Very interesting. You're making my brain hurt a little bit, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Good, I like it. Okay. So, wow, we've already over an hour. That's great. It's awesome when things go by that quickly. Where are you hoping? So what have you got coming up as far as the YouTube channel goes? Are you working on a book? What kind of stuff have you got going on?
Yeah, I mean, the videos, it's still pretty experimental. I just need to get outside and shoot some more footage. I need to find some more different variety of venues, you know, places I can go. I'm going to be traveling a little bit this spring, so hopefully I can do some videos at different locations and maybe even talk about ideas that might be relevant in those places. But yeah, book, I am working on a book. The book would be... mostly the content would be the sorts of things I do in my blog, which is groundbelief.com, like ground beef, but ground belief, you know. So, but my blog, what I've hoped to do, and you talked about bridge building earlier, is I would love for my blog to be a resource for anyone who wants to think better, whether they're theist or atheist or agnostic or whatever their worldview is, because I think the principles of good thinking and believing apply to everybody. They apply to every worldview. And so I'm hoping to be able to talk about things that anyone could get on there and find helpful. And so the book would be that same purpose, to be a resource for helping anyone improve their stock of beliefs and be able to recognize how to form good beliefs, how to evaluate your beliefs and even change your mind when important to do or when needed. So that's the book project. That's still a ways off, you know. It could probably be another year or so.
Okay. So I've been hammering you for a while. Do you have any questions?
Oh, wow. Well, I'd love to hear your story. You know, I shared a little bit of mine, and I'd love to hear your story of your intellectual journey.
Okay. Well, everybody's heard my story before, but I'll share it again, basically for you. I was raised on a diet of child sacrifice and Satan worship. I was raised essentially as a Christian. My mom was Catholic, kind of a high holiday Catholic, and my dad was mostly non-practicing Lutheran, which every time mm-hmm. I tell that to Christians, they cock their heads like, oh, that whole relationship is an anathema. But it seemed to work for them. And so I was, you know, raised kind of in the, you know, high holiday Catholic tradition. You know, there was always the assertion that, you know, there's this God walking around there and you should always, you know, do the right thing and so on and so forth. And I started asking a lot of questions. Mom sent me off to church. And when I started asking them really serious questions and they kept on telling me to have faith and read the Bible, well, I did that. I read the Bible, and I tell people a lot of times the best way to become an atheist is to read the Bible. and then, you know, you start reading more and investigating more and stuff like that. And I think I made my way from, you know, from theist through agnosticism and then into atheism. And I accept the fact that I could be wrong, that there could absolutely be, you know, a God or gods out there somewhere. But I don't see any good reason to think that there are. And when it comes to the God of Christianity, that's when I kind of put my hard hat on. And when I look at the Bible, I think to myself, you know, that God, as depicted in that book, is a monster that I am morally superior to, and needs to beg the, you know, everything in existence for forgiveness for the way it acted, if in fact the Bible is true.
Wow.
So, but it's interesting. I've talked to lots of different people, and I've run a gamut, you know, and talking to people like everyone from people like, you know, Kent Hovind and do you know who Cy Ten Brugenkade is?
No, I don't.
He's a presuppositional apologist. He's a fellow.
Oh, yeah.
He's a fellow Canuck, and he actually came in studio and did an interview with Dean and I. And you know, he starts with his conclusion and asserts his assumptions, which is always fun. And, you know, from people like that all the way through other people who are more philosophically minded, like you, like, Blake Genta. Do you know who Blake Genta is?
No.
You can check it. He's got a website called Belief Map, where he talks about, you know, things from a more philosophical perspective and kind of the whole gamut in between, you know. And you see the people like on YouTube, people like Kevin Anderson, who are just walking horrible billboards for Christianity, and, you know, kind of the, you know, everything in between. And I've seen that, you know. That's why I asked you at the, you know, the onset, you know, what kind of Christian are you? Because it's like, you know, saying I have a car.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So it's been interesting, but one of the things that I've found to be kind of the common thread is this, you know, is this belief that I can never seem to get people to offer a justification for. You know, like, you know, why do you, a huge fan of the Atheist Experience. I'm sure you know who they are.
Yeah, I have heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, one of the things that the host will always ask, you know, is what do you believe and why?
Hmm.
And it's that why question that's always the most thought provoking.
Yeah.
You know, so, okay, so you believe this thing. Why? And then just wait and see what people say.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I mean, I think that's a great thing to be asking people. And I wish it were asked more in the churches, you know, as people are being raised there. That should be an important thing to talk about. But yeah. It's kind of, I don't know if it was different at one point. Maybe it's always been that way, but I would love to see that conversation happening more in faith communities.
Yeah, it's interesting. I try to practice. You familiar with a guy named Pete Boghossian?
Yeah.
So he wrote this whole thing, Manual for Creating Atheists, and Anthony Magnabosco kind of took it, I think, further than Pete Boghossian ever thought he would. In this whole street epistemology thing, and I go downtown Toronto. There's this place called Yonge Dundas Square, and it's kind of like a very, very small but still cool version of Times Square. Any day of the week, except, you know, when it's minus 3,000 outside, you'll find the street preacher out there on his milk crate, screaming about, you know, end times and all that other fun stuff.
Right.
And, I'll typically go up and engage and they're like, why do you, you know, what do you believe? Oh yeah, this is what I, why do you believe it? And it's one of the things that I've always found very interesting is the, at least in the people who don't seem to have the capacity for introspection, like I think people like you do, is they've been told this thing, and I don't even know how much they believe it, but they just puppet it because it's what they've been told. You know, and when I'll say to people, you know, it's like, well, you know, why do you believe? Well, it's a look in the Bible and stuff like that, and they'll flip to Romans 1 and show me how, look, you believe it too, the Bible says. And I'm like, yeah, but the Bible also says that bats are birds. No, it doesn't. And I flip to the part where it says bats are birds, or rabbits chew cud, you know, or that, you know, things like that. The Bible doesn't say stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, it does. Look. And they just kind of sit there, you know, flummoxed. And, you know, the conversation resets and they go back to Romans 1 and say that I'm, you know, possessed or something like that.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, no, I get it.
So,
yeah. And I think I wish more people would not fear these kinds of conversations. I think it would be good for everyone. Everyone would benefit. Hey, I've got something I need to mention that
I
can't believe I should have mentioned it right at the beginning. Just, it would have given me some instant credibility. but my next blog post that I'm currently working on is a tribute to Neil Peart.
Oh, yes. Rush, yeah.
I don't know if you're a fan of Rush or Neil Peart.
I'm not a fan of Geddy Lee. I find his voice annoying, but I'm that Canadian who doesn't really like Rush, doesn't drink beer, and doesn't care about hockey.
Oh no.
Yeah. I'm like that Canadian. Trinity. Yeah, I'm that Canadian. But no, yeah, Neil Peart is, you know, certainly, you know, the drummer who could do no wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I realized as I thought about this blog post, Neil Peart, I have to give him some credit for my love of philosophy, because listening to the lyrics of Rush's music back in the 80s, early 80s, was when I first really started thinking about stuff like this. And I think it had a lot to do with Neil Peart and the things he was writing about in his music. Of course, you know, there's a lot written and talked about with his own worldview and, But I admired him as a musician and just as a thinker. And he's, you know, Rush for sure, some of my heroes, musical heroes in a lot of ways. And so I know that's near your neck of the woods. That's their origin spot.
Yep, for sure. So. Yeah. So everybody listening, be sure to check out groundbelief.com for Chris's blog. And be sure to check out YouTube and just look up Chris Gadsden and look at those videos. It's very, very cool. And if you've never been to Missouri, you'll have a quick little, you know, one-dimensional view of what Missouri looks like. And if you haven't been down there, go down there. It's quite nice. At least at the time of year I was down there, it was quite nice. I'm not sure what the weather's like there right now. We're at... what would the temperature conversion be? We'd be sitting around about 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm. Yeah, we're not quite as cold.
Yeah.
We're getting snow, but it's not quite that bad. Winters aren't too extreme here.
I remember I was in Minneapolis, St. Paul a bunch of years ago on business. And I was talking to a couple people there. And we went to the Mall of America. And I was telling people, oh, yeah, where are you from? Oh, from Toronto. Oh, what's it like up there? And I pulled up my phone. This is in the early days of smartphones. And wasn't able to get much in the way of, you know, kind of Google Maps, but I was able to show them basically that, you know, where we were in Minneapolis, St. Paul was about 100 miles north of where Toronto was.
That's hilarious.
And it was, oh, what do you mean? And I said, yeah, you know, look at Point Pelee here. It's the southernmost part of Canada, and you draw a straight line across, and it's the same latitude as Northern California. Lots of people, there are lots of people who don't know that. And when I say here that we will typically in the hottest of the of our summers see 100-degree weather, like for weeks at a time. And wow, people are just flabbergasted. What do you mean? It's Canada. I'm like, yes, it's Canada. We get hot. Lake Ontario is a body of water that has the capacity to affect weather in huge ways. So now I'm babbling. So how else can people reach out to you, Chris, if they want to talk to you, they got questions or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, the YouTube channel and the website, there are both ways to contact me by email there. And I don't get emails that often, or you can comment, you know, leave comments in there and I'll respond to comments. Those are probably the best ways to do it. You know, if somebody's got something that is too big for a comment, you know, you could email me. Probably the, I don't know if you give out email addresses on podcasts.
But, help yourself. It's up to you. It's your email.
Yeah, my email is cgad123@gmail.com. So cgad123@gmail. So, if you had a longer kind of discussion you wanted to have, that would maybe be a better format, email. So, but yeah, I love having comments and on my blog and YouTube channel. And I love pushback, you know, respectful pushback. It's always good to be challenged. And I've grown so much as a thinker because of very respectful atheists and agnostics who have pushed back on things I've said in the past. So it's very helpful.
Yeah, it's not till your second appearance on the podcast that I call you an idiot. So this one's a freebie.
I'll try to be more controversial and edgy next time.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, we're just about an hour and 20, which is a typical episode for us. I'm always long-winded, but this has been a great conversation.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you so much for coming on. And I think if you're up to it, I think we should do this again. I think it's been good, and I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I'd love that. Once some other interesting topic comes up, we want to talk about it. And, you know, I guess Rush is not a good topic. You're not a big fan, but I don't know hockey. I grew up in Florida, so I'm even, you know, more ignorant of hockey, even though we have a couple teams down there, but not when I was a kid. So, I'd love to do it again. It'd be a lot of fun.
Okay. So we'll do our regular little sign off, and then I'll push the stop button, and we'll say a proper goodbye offline. Or at least off recording.
All right.
And so again, thanks so much. Again, groundbelief.com and probably youtube.com/ChrisGadson.
It'd be Christopher Gadson.
Christopher, pardon me.
Yeah.
And check out those videos for sure. And we'll look forward to those blog posts. And then about a year, when you're not teaching or walking around Missouri, you can get your book out.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully I'll get that done. But thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's been really fun and a privilege.
All right. So I guess that's enough trouble for us to get into for this week. We'll be back at you probably next week with episode 100. And I promise I'll unlock Dean and let him out of my basement for that recording. But until that time, I have been Michael. This is where you say I've been Chris.
And I've been Chris.
And we shall talk to you later. Bye-bye.
This has been the CA. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please drop by the iTunes store and give us a review and subscribe to get the latest episodes as soon as they release. Just a reminder, the views expressed on this broadcast are solely those of the hosts and are for entertainment purposes only. Never take advice from two guys expressing an opinion on a podcast. That's just silly. See you back here soon.